I want you to think, if you haven't already, of a situation in your life that you're facing right now. And it's too hard. It's too hard for you. And it's something that won't improve. You've had long enough to watch it, to wait for it, to hope that it will get better, but it isn't. It's too big. It may not be a Caroline. You just learned of a woman's name that most will never meet in this place. Maybe it's for you something that's just too strong. You're not a wimp. You're not a weakling, but this thing's way stronger than you. I want you to get that in your mind, and maybe it's just too something other to overcome for you. And before I go on, I want you to take out that little sheet of paper that's for taking notes, okay? And I would like you to write just discreetly on that sheet what it is, okay? It could be something very personal, an addiction you have. It could be something that's more generic, a trajectory of economic challenge that you're facing. I don't know. Could be somebody far away that you don't know how to help, but they need help. I'm ringing here, Michael, so I'm not sure what to do here. But so I want you to think about that, and let me give a word to that situation that you're thinking about and some of you have already written down. Let's call it what it is. It's impossible. Okay? It's impossible. We use that word to describe things that are, in spite of our efforts, we it's not like we're lazy and, you know, whatever, c'est la vie, you know, que sera, sera, whatever. No, it's we care deeply about it. We just can't fix it. And it's got you vexed in a rather constant way. In spite of your efforts, you cannot work it out. You cannot make it better, and you, worst of all, cannot change it at all. All right? Now, I'm describing what I think aptly describes my experience with John and Glenn in Kenya the last 2 weeks. We saw version after version of that. We've just shared Caroline briefly. And there's more, and we'll show you pictures next week. But everywhere you looked, there was this sense of, how can this get better, God? Man, how can you go from here to here and make it better? I did something really dumb yesterday. I went to the mall. I don't like the mall on a normal day, but it's really stupid when you're just coming off 2 weeks in a developing third world country. And I saw these poor, troubled people waiting in these, it looked like Disneyland, the roped lines out in front of this store that was debuting a brand new 6S product. It happens to be a cell phone. Hundreds of people there. I walked by that store and, you know, I saw some of them, they're all giddy and happy and isn't this the best day of my life? And then there's others that are just like, you know what? I got hate in my heart. I wish I could just plain take about 100 of you out and that way I'm further up in line. And I looked at these people and I'm one of them. I wasn't there for a phone. I got my customary sucker at See's Candy, which are now 85 cents, I might add. They were a nickel when I was a child. Why did I say that? That makes me sound really, really old, doesn't it? Really, really old. Same sucker, just 80 cents more. But they give you a bonus candy. I don't know if you've done it. Try it. But anyway, it's kind of fun. But that image as I'm walking through the mall was troublesome to me. And I whispered to myself, I didn't stand up on a table someplace and make a scene, but I whispered to myself, first world problems. Here we go again, first world problems. Did I mention parking was a nightmare in the mall? First world problems. Will you say it with me? First world problems. Now, I'm not ripping on anybody, but I live in the first world. So do you. So we've got to find a way in the first world, or all the way over in Kenya in the third world, approaching second world in some places, to manage the impossible. That's what I want to talk about. For you right now, you may have written on your page a health problem. It's not getting better. You cannot fix it. And it appears, at least, you can't change it. It might be a money problem of some kind. Never mind they make a few dollars a day, tops, the fortunate ones that have a job. 65% of the country's unemployed. But that doesn't minimize the reality that you're out of money. Your problems are big, and you have no resources to meet those needs. I call that should be on your page if that's where you're at right now. Or maybe, and this probably tops the list of complicated problems, relational problems. And I say that because it's not just what you can do, there's another person involved, right? So it's what you can do times two that makes relational problems, marital and otherwise, really complex. When there's dysfunction or complete failure in a relationship, it's a long shot for that reason that it'll get better. It is big. So we say something's impossible when we lack the ability or the knowledge or maybe money in some cases to make it better. I could tell you lots of stories that we saw last week. We will next week. But I want to tell you, my first memory was early in our marriage, we didn't and couldn't have children. And for year after year, month after month, we longed for something that couldn't happen. Almost to the day in our ninth anniversary as a married couple, we welcomed our first daughter into our lives, and we have two other children since. I think Debbie and I would both agree on the word that was an impossible situation. There were no treatments, there were no methods or solutions. And we came close one time about year seven, and we lost that baby, and it was crushing to us. So we know from that experience what impossible looks like. We also then, in the fifth year of our youngest child's life, faced a second, for me anyway, a second time of impossible. When she was diagnosed as a baby, as an infant, a newborn, with a heart problem. She needed surgery at age five. And I was in way over my head. It was more than I could do. It was more than I could handle. I knew nothing about how to fix her medically. I know what it's like to say, God, help me and help my unbelief, because I was wavering. And some of you came alongside all those years ago and walked with me and us during a very difficult season of impossible. And in both cases, God worked things out and came through wonderfully. I think it would be incorrect to say that's absolutely a certainty every time. Turns out it was in our case. But some of you have been living with an impossible for a lot longer. And I want to be honest with you. I don't know how it's going to turn out in this life. It may. I think that's what we pray for. But meanwhile, we say, God, help us, while we wait and hope and want and long for things to get better. I want to, let's call a sizable struggle this morning a mountain. Okay, let's give it that label and it'll make sense. So there's lots of different mountains. We were in a land where the big mountain there is Mount Kilimanjaro. So I asked the crowd recently in one of the gatherings, actually it was Church in the Village, I said, how many of you have climbed Mount Kilimanjaro? there's 100 or so people there. Not one hand went up. And I looked around. I expected that answer. Then I said, how many of you have ever been to Mount Kilimanjaro? It's on the border of Kenya and Tanzania, is it? I'm not sure. Yeah. And again, no hands went up. Not surprising, because most of these people have no means of travel whatsoever. In our world, Mount Hood comes to mind. It's a big mountain. Have any of you been to Mount Hood? Any of you tried to climb it? See? Let's go bigger than that. Rainier. Any of you been to Rainier? How about tried to climb it? How about succeeded? Okay. All right. We're getting there. How about the land where my oldest daughter lives? Alaska. Mount McKinley. Even though a guy recently tried to rename it. But anyway, Mount McKinley, known by locals as Denali. It's big. Anybody been there? Anybody tried to climb it? Okay. Now, my point here is that they are mountains that are really big and really tall and really going to stay in that place. They're immovable. Now, some say it can't be climbed. I can't go there, and they don't even try. Others have tried and they've given up short of the top. In other words, they set out to climb a mountain, but I don't know what happened. They got injured on the way. They got fatigued, and they mentally met exhaustion, to say nothing of the physical challenge. And then there are others that that said, no, I'm going to try to climb it, and it's as hard as anything I've ever tried, but I'm not going to quit. I will not give up. I will keep climbing. The story of Exodus, where God delivered his people who had been held captive by Pharaoh for hundreds of years. There's a reason it's the most talked about miracle in the Bible. My Bible's open to Exodus chapter 2, actually. I want you to turn there with me this morning for a few thoughts from this wonderful story. Most talked about miracle in the Bible. Can you guess why? There's no book I can't point to the Bible passage and say, here's why, because it says right here. But you can speculate why. It was an amazing miracle in the Bible. And it's described, this Exodus, by the book bearing the same name, Exodus. And it's told in chapter 14, but I want you to back up why I had you turn to chapter 2. For a couple of verses here to sort of frame what's happening here. These Israelites enslaved for, I said, hundreds of years, more than 400. That's four plus centuries. If you're counting in biblical times, it's roughly 10 generations of people. It's one family who has children, and children, children, 10 times, roughly. Okay, that's a long time. For generations, the common conclusion was that this will never get better. Our situation is immovable. We are stuck. It doesn't matter how hard you cry or how long you pray, it's not going to fix it. Can you find your way there to a despairing sort of a... the word fatalism comes to mind. It's going to stay this way. No use in even fiddling with it. We're stuck. Generations came and went believing that God doesn't hear, doesn't see, and worst of all, doesn't care. I don't need you to show me your hand, but is the thing on your page close to that for you? I'm not sure God hears. It's possible he doesn't see. And in my case, I'm not even sure he cares. And Pastor, I've got reasons. I screwed up. I went off the rails at some point in my life. And I think this is just a big cosmic case of payback. You ever think like that? You wouldn't be alone, by the way. There's a whole bunch of people that think that way. All right. It was a deeply held belief that things for these people will never improve. Never going to get better. I can't capture in the shortness of our time the collective pessimism that existed in the day. If you've been around conditions that remain the same for as long and far back as anybody can look, you start to just go, whatever. That's who we are. There's some special people in the world, and there's some scum. I'm in the scum category. Now it's getting real, isn't it? By the way, I visited a land that pessimism runs deep. It does. Because they can look as far back as they want to look, and their situation has not changed. So, all of this, however, is about to change. Look at these words that announce a little hint of what's coming. Verse 23, during that long period, and it was long, the king of Egypt died, and the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. But God was too busy and couldn't care less. That's how the instinctive reader of these words would have thought. We've done this cry thing forever. He's busy, he's distracted, he's preoccupied, got more important things going on, and therefore couldn't care less. Verse 24 reads different than that, doesn't it? God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And notice, God saw, he looked on the Israelites and was indifferent. The word I read is concerned about them. It's the same word as cared about them. So God sets in motion a plan to do the impossible. Before we find our way to chapter 14 and wrap things up there, look across the page as he's briefing Moses. God's briefing Moses on this plan in verse 7 of chapter 3. The Lord says to Moses, I've indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. That's one of those verses I hope you'll tuck away and put next to the thing that's on your page right now. I've heard, I've seen, I care about their suffering. I'm concerned. So I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a land that is good and spacious, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites. Hard word, hard word, hard word. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me. Is that great? It came my way and I heard it. And I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now, Moses, go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And for an unknown amount of time, God then, in chapters 3, 4, 5, and 6, prepares Moses for this epic mission. That's what's happening in those chapters. And then chapter 7 introduces a series of plagues meant to soften the resistance and to persuade Pharaoh, who was entrenched in his position, to persuade him to think differently about these people and, in fact, let them go. And there are 10 plagues altogether. You know the story, the plagues of blood, the turning of the Nile waters into blood. By the way, I ate perch from the Nile. It doesn't have a blood taste anymore. It's kind of good. But it's weird to look at a whole fish that's looking at you. But anyway, that's the plague of blood started it all. Plague of frogs, chapter 8. Gnats, flies. Easy words to read. I was preaching some of these words in one of the settings there, and one fly kept afflicting me. It felt a little bit like I was starting to think thoughts like Jonah when he was, you know, he was preoccupied with this irritating little worm, you know, and I'm saying big, glorious things for God, and this fly is just after me. I'm like, you know, I'll get you. And he's like, no, you won't. And there's this big showdown, right? Well, that's one fly. Can you picture flies completely covering everything? You, the person next to you, the chair you're seated in, the floor, everything, buzzing. You can't hardly see through the haze of flies or gnats. There's frogs everywhere. Then livestock, the plague against them, and they begin to die off. And then it gets really personal, chapter 9, the plague of boils. They're covered in terrible sores. And then hail comes, and it's his biblical proportion, but the next best thing is go to Texas after a hailstorm and see what it did to brand new cars in a car lot. It's awful. It's total destruction. And then locusts, chapter 10, lead to darkness across the land. And then finally we come to the plague on the firstborn, chapter 11. Each time Pharaoh resists, and then comes the last plague, death, to the firstborn males, both human and animal, cattle. This is an important point that ties to the cross, and you got to understand it. God arranged this, and it's why Passover, it's really the birthplace of the word Passover. How many have heard the word Passover? Okay, everybody, right? How many really think they understand it? Fewer, and that's not surprising. Here's the deal. Passover was where God said, I'm going to send this last plague, and it's the death angel going to come into the camp at night and is going to snuff out, kill, stop the breathing of the firstborn male in every household and among cattle. It's going to happen in one night. And there's not one oldest son that will survive it, except you who know this little secret. You're to take the blood from an unblemished lamb and you're to wipe it over the doorpost and the header of the front door leading into your home. And that will signal to the death angel to pass over your home, sparing your son. And indeed, the very thing happened that night. Who knew that secret? God's people only. In the middle of the night, this is all captured for you in chapter 12. In the middle of the night, terrible, terrible wailing went on, actually chapter 11 and into chapter 12. It was an awful scene. And the scourge had happened, making Pharaoh finally say, get out of here, leave now. And they did. So that's pretty much covers my story this morning, right? I'm going to close our Bibles there and call it a good one. Right? I love stories that turn out that simple. Problem solved. Mountain climbed. Not so fast. As he had done so many times before, Pharaoh changed his mind again. And he gives chase in chapter 14. So would you land there, and we'll land it here with some of these words. Chapter 14, Pharaoh changes his mind. Verse 5 tells us, when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, that's God's people, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, what have we done? We've let the Israelites go and lost this is free labor. We lost their services. So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt with the officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites who were marching out boldly. They were heading east. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them at the Red Sea. That's where those coordinates take you. They came upon them and caught up with them at this point. Now, if you're one of those people and you're enjoying this grand party as you're making your way to freedom and our new future, finally looking at your past 430 years and saying, "It happened. Pinch me, somebody. It's really true. We climbed that mountain. We've been set free. Cross that thing off your page." Do you hear something? Those are hoofbeats. What? Oh my goodness, look, everybody. And they turn around, and from very passionate hearts, very troubled hearts, these words appear. Pharaoh approached, verse 10. The Israelites looked up, and there they were, marching after them. The chase was on. And they were, as I would be, terrified and cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? Is this just a big game?" Imagine how quickly all this happened. "What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, we'll serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die here in the desert." Terrible moment. They were trapped. There was no way out. They were certain that they would either die by the sword or drown in the sea. Have you ever been in that spot? Or maybe that's your situation right now. You got looking over your shoulder, there's approaching enemy, and you're gonna die by their sword, or your only other option is to go forward and you will drown in the sea. It's called a rock and a hard spot. It's a classic example of just that fact. Put yourself on that shore if you haven't already, and you know what it feels like to face an impossible situation. No way out. I'm sure at that moment they quickly thought through possibilities. "We could go around. There's a million or more of us. That's not likely. They are bearing down quickly on us. Okay, we can cross that off. We can't go around. We can go over." No, a bridge would take forever to build. Can't happen. "Well, we can go under." Again, a tunnel. It takes engineering. It takes all sorts of work that won't happen in the shortness of this moment. That was it. The end was now. I'm sure I would have felt that if I was on that shore. And maybe all of us to some extent would have. A few with rock solid faith might have persevered. But look, please don't miss what Moses says next, verse 13 of chapter 14. Moses answered the people, "Don't be afraid." Are you kidding me? "Stand firm and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today," looking back, "you will never see them again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." And what follows to finish this chapter is God, the God of the impossible, showing up big. And I know we've got 3 or 4 minutes to capture this, so please draw into this. I want to read this, even if you've read it last week, it's worth reading again. The Lord said to Moses, "Why are the people crying to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch out your hands over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. We thought around wouldn't work. Over can't work. Under can't work. God says there's one more preposition, through. Spread out your hands, Moses. I will harden the heart of Egyptians so that they will go in after you. And I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the angel of God, I've missed this in all the previous times I've read this. The angel of God, who had been traveling in front of Israel's army, withdrew. Picture him flying from front to back, and he went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front and stood behind them. But notice this peculiar attribute coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. Throughout the night, darkness, the cloud brought darkness to the one side, to the Egyptian side. So the Egyptians are looking and they're like, it's total dark. It's nightfall. But look what happened on the other side. The other side was light. So neither went near the other all night long. So God somehow miraculously moves the angel, moves the cloud. It goes behind him. It's darkness to the Egyptians, but it's bright, call it daylight, for God's people to see their way forward. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind, and it turned into the dry land. The waters divided. Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on the right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued them, and all of Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea. During the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud of the Egyptians' army at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. He jammed the wheels of their chariots so that they had difficulty driving. Sounds like a scene from Kenya, actually. And the Egyptians said, "Let's get away from the Israelites." Wow, that's a change. The Lord is fighting for them against us. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea, and notice, not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. That day the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians laying dead on the shore, a silent reminder of God's power to do the impossible. And when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people appropriately feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his leader. I want you to take a couple of really important touch points away from this very familiar story. The first is this: his resources, God's resources, and God's resolve know no bounds. His resources and his resolve know no bounds. Can you imagine if we had a small God and he comes up with this first plague and it didn't work? What do small gods do? Yeah, I gave it a shot. Guess that's it. Pockets are empty. No other possibility. Not our God. God of you and me, the living God, the true God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, that God says, no, this is all part of a large plan. My resources, my resolve, I'm not going away. I'm going to work through this until it's overcome. And I'm now talking about the thing that you wrote down. We'll work together through this. Together, we will work through this. You can do this. with my help. That's why verse 16 was so important. I slowed down to say, God says, no, you can go through the sea. Psalm 77 was quoted earlier, one of my favorite verses in the Psalms, Psalm 77, 19. God, you made a pathway through the ocean, a pathway no one knew was there. Isn't that great? In other words, he doesn't give you a memo saying, here's how we're going to roll. Do you guess there was a single person, one person in a million or more, that had a clue what was going to happen? Including Moses. I don't believe so. Moses heard the larger narrative. I'm going to work it out. Watch my glory. But I'll bet Moses' jaw dropped like everybody else's, like, whew, whew, whew. Follow me, fellas. I guarantee that was it. That's what makes impossible so cool. What kind of God does that? The God that Jesus described in Luke 18, verse 27, what is impossible for man is possible with God. I'd like you to bow your heads with me this morning. Because I want to conclude by connecting with brothers and sisters far away. Because aside from circumstances, it's about the same for all of us, isn't it? It's first world or third world or second world problems. But problems are problems. Impossible is impossible. If you're tempted this morning to stop climbing, whatever mountain it is you're climbing, if you're tempted to stop climbing, and you're starting to think, you know, it can't be done. I can't do that. Or maybe you're thinking even more dire, I will die trying. The Bible's counsel to you this morning is the same as it was to Moses. Be still and watch God work. If you aren't sure you can endure any longer, the Apostle Paul's counsel works for you too. Cling to God's grace even if he doesn't fix the problem right away. And if whatever's on your sheet of paper is something you're not sure you can make better, believe what the Apostle Paul understood when he said, I can do all things through Christ's strength. God, I pray for Caroline. I pray for Ted and Brenda, who work in impossible situations. And I pray for every single person hearing your truth this morning, that God, we would have a new courage that is reflected in the resolve that I can do this through Christ. Strengthen us, even if the weight and the struggle has been long, years, decades long. Help us to live, even if we don't see the outcome yet, in victory. Because we are conquerors in Christ.